It's the amazing Rico Bronya podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is Rico Bronya. The New York Mets take on a team that gave up a few days ago, the San Francisco Giants, a team that started selling off their entire bullpen, a team that the Mets had annihilated not too long ago, a team that the Pittsburgh Pirates had annihilated. The Mets faced that team at Citi Field, and in front of a combined total of about 125,000 fans, the New York Mets absolutely crapped the bed. That's what happened over the weekend against the San Francisco Giants. We will analyze about said crap that was taken by the New York Mets over these 3 days as they lose 2 out of 3 to the crappy San Francisco Giants. I don't have the fullest of voices because I spent my Sunday night at SummerSlam. And that was quite an experience, especially when you have two young boys that need to be held up so they can see all the action. So my arms are sore, my back is sore, my voice is sore, and the Mets stink. So, you know, you combine all that, I'm in a wonderful mood. But hopefully you're in a great mood, whether consuming the Rico Bronya live on a very, very late Sunday night, early Monday morning, or you decided to download this podcast on your way to work on a Monday morning as the Mets get set to play 3 games against Cleveland and hopefully just get this horrible taste out of their mouth. So you start with Friday, because Friday night was the kind of game in which it felt sort of magical. As frustrating as the first 8 innings were, you know, the Mets are down 2-0. The offense can't do dick against Robbie Ray. They can't even put rallies together. Then when they finally do, you know, we got to see just incredibly stupid managing by Carlos Mendoza when he decides to take the red hot Mark Vientos and stick his ass on the bench for Brett Beatty, which I'll get into in a few more minutes. But you're down 3-0 late after David Peterson gives you a solid six innings. And you see an offense that can't figure out Robbie Ray, which to a degree is understandable because Robbie's had a good year. It is a guy that's won a Cy Young before. But when you rally the way they did, Pete hitting the opposite field home run, Piazza-esque to right center field. I actually only said Piazza-esque because, and I haven't gotten to it yet, we had this great emailer that put together the Rico Bronya bingo card. And it's so accurate with some of the things that I say that Pete does. And one of the things on the Rico Bronya bingo card is that anytime I see an opposite field home run hit by a right-hand hitter, I always say Piazza-esque. So I threw that in there for the bingo, which I promise we'll get to one of these days on an upcoming Rico Bronya. But you get Pete hit the home run number 250. You get the rally in the eighth inning, which shockingly featured a clutch hit by Juan Soto, which is so few and far between. You see Pete get the sacrifice fly to tie the game. And it did feel like, well, all right, Mets are going to come back from 3-0 down. They're showing off the new toys in their bullpen. This is going to be a good win. This is going to be a nice cleansing after what happened in San Diego. And they do nothing in the bottom of the ninth inning, including Cedric Mullins making his Met debut by hitting a weak-ass pop-up to third base. And even when Diaz gave up the run in the 10th inning, you're set up to come back and win the game anyway. Because the odds of getting through one of these runner on second, nobody out situations, you know, it's not extremely high. So it sucked when Edwin gave up the RBI hit to, of all people, Dom Smith. But to his credit, he got 2 big outs. And so instead of San Francisco saddling Edwin Diaz with 2, 3, 4 runs to really break the game open, I went in there bottom of the 10th inning with the top of the order coming up feeling, and this I guess shows my naivete on this team, I felt good. I did. And I was watching this game, by the way, hours after it ended. So my naivete sometimes is matched by I have this feeling I know what my team did, even though I haven't seen them play and the game's been over for multiple hours. And so I actually went into the bottom of the 10th inning after the Mets had rallied to make it 3-3 and gave up the lead in the ninth inning. I actually felt good. I figured top of the order, they're going to hit Randy Rodriguez because A, they hit Randy last time they saw him, and B, Randy Rodriguez is forced into a new role. You know, part of the ramifications of a team trading off big bullpen arms is that somebody on that team is going to get elevated to the closer's role. and Randy Rodriguez, who's had a great year, I figured, you know, this is going to be a tough moment for him. You know, it's one thing to have a really good year when you're pitching the sixth or seventh inning, but here you are now in the bottom of the 10th inning. There's already a runner on second base. I thought the Mets were going to hit him. I did. And when Brandon Nimmo came up and very quickly popped up the second base, my confidence took a little bit of a hit because I thought, you know, at the least bit, Brandon will hit a ground ball to second base. He'll hit a deep fly ball to right field. At least they could advance that tying run. Didn't do it. And after Lindor got hit by the first pitch, and now they're set up with two on and one out, and here comes Juan Soto. Damn it. I did the same thing that I've done 15 times this season, and I got to stop doing. Which is, I thought, oh, here's Juan Soto's Met moment. I mean, how many freaking times have I or you or anyone listening or consuming the Rico thought, well, this is going to be Juan Soto's moment? And what does he do? On the second pitch, he hits, I'm going to use this phrase a lot today on the Rico, it's the phrase of the show, a weak-ass pop-up to second base. And I'm not a booer, but I wanted to boo. I was so disgusted. Because even though he had the base hit in the eighth inning, which was clutch, that was an inch away from being a double play too, which Juan's been known to do. So even though, yes, he did get a clutch hit in the eighth inning, here he comes up with two on and one out. The tying run's on second base. And look, if he hits a line drive right at somebody, it's like, all right, bad luck. It's been the case for Juan all season long with guys on base. And instead, he pops up the second base. I don't know if he's pressing. I don't. Mendy says he's just chasing pitches out of the strike zone. Okay. Whatever he's doing ain't good enough. And this was said a lot about Pete Alonso last year, so let's be fair. Pete Alonso ended up putting up decent numbers a year ago, but we said they were empty. There was a lot of empty calories. Let's be honest about Juan Soto's numbers. A lot of it, not all. He's had clutch moments. Not a lot of clutch moments. And key, not enough clutch moments. Two on, one out, down a run, team's on a three-game losing streak, and he pops up to second base. It ain't good enough. It hasn't been good enough. They need more from this guy. And I'm not going to cite how much money he makes. I'm just going to say he's the third place hitter on this team. They need more from him. But even after he popped up to second base, here comes Pete Alonso. And as bad as Pete's been, and Pete was mired, and I guess you could still sort of say is mired in a long batting slump, Pete at least hit a home run that got the Mets on the board two innings earlier, and at least came up and hit a sacrifice fly to tie the game. So Pete at least put together after the two strikeouts to start, and really the awful stretch he's on, he at least put together back-to-back good plate appearances that led the Mets to coming back in this game. And in that 10th inning, had a good at-bat. And he drew a walk. And it set up Ronnie Mauricio with the bases loaded. And that's your only choice. Because once Mendy used Mauricio to pinch hit for Marte in the 8th inning, and it worked because Mauricio drew a walk, even though Brett Beatty would come up and do nothing, they had no other option but Ronnie Mauricio. And this is the moment where I didn't know what to think. Because Ronnie's had the clutch moment for this team, including against Randy Rodriguez a week earlier when he hit the home run. And another clutch moment a few days later against San Diego. So Ronnie hasn't melted in the big moment. He's just been very inconsistent. But I could tell on strike two he was done. And Rodriguez eventually blows a fastball right by him. Mets leave the bases loaded. They finish 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position. And they lose the Friday game. And it really set the tone for the weekend. It did. I know you couldn't beat the Giants every single time you face them. But you're on a three-game losing streak. You're playing an extra inning game at home. The Giants just dumped their entire bullpen. Tyler Rogers to the Mets, obviously Camilo Duvall to the Yankees. You're forced, if you're San Francisco, to ask Joey Lucchesi and Jose Buteau and Ryan Walker and now Randy Rodriguez to get big outs, and the Mets can't take advantage of it. Friday absolutely sucked. But I think what sucked the most about Friday was Mendy pinch hitting for Mark Vientos with Brett Beatty. You cannot, and I don't think Carlos has at times. That's why this was so disappointing. You know, I remember last year, Mendy a lot managed with his gut. And he managed not with what stats would tell you or overthinking righty-lefty or overthinking what the analytics will tell you. Analytics are important. Righty-lefty, lefty-lefty is important. Career numbers against a pitcher is important. There's a lot of things that matter. But at the end of the day, you still have to use your brain and your stomach, and you got to marry them. And I thought Mendy in his first year married him a lot. There's nothing in your stomach or even your brain that would tell you to take a hot hitter in Mark Vientos out for a cold hitter in Brett Beatty. And Mendy's answer for why he did it was basically a knock on Jose Buteau and a knock on what we watched this entire season. He said, well, you know, Jose struggled against lefties. We saw a lot of that. So I figured, let's throw a lefty against him. Now, in theory, that makes sense, right? I mean, sure, okay. We saw Buteau crap the bed against lefties a lot. So put up a lefty against him. That works if your right-hand hitter in Mark Vientos isn't hot, which he pretty much was, and Brett Beatty is not, which has been the case for a while now. So you can lefty-lefty, righty-righty it up your ass. If you have a player that's not hitting, why are you in a rush to get him in the game? And there could be another opportunity to use said player. But in this case, Mendy took out Mark Vientos. He goes to Brett Beatty. I did not like the move. I don't think anyone liked the move. And instead of making us look like horses' asses, which Beatty could have done by ripping a game-winning hit, this is right after Alonso with the sac fly to tie the game in the eighth and Mauricio drew a walk. Instead, Beatty grounds out. And it's one of the many missed opportunities the Mets would have late in this game. And they had quite a few. And I didn't love the lineup that Carlos put out there to begin with. Cedric Mullins was there. The Mets have just acquired him. And Tyrone Taylor, speaking of someone who is not hot, speaking of someone who is should have lost any role on this team outside of coming in late for defense or being a late inning pinch runner, because Tyrone Taylor hasn't hit forever, and you start him in this game. Why? Why is Cedric Mullins not starting this game? Cedric Mullins has hit lefties all season long. We talked about that on the last Rico. And Cedric Mullins actually had good career numbers against Robbie Ray. So don't give me this, well, he just got here. Who cares if he just got here? Remember when Matt Reynolds, like, was traveling at 5 o'clock in the morning, showed up in Cincinnati for a day game, I think it was Labor Day, and hit a game-winning home run? Did it matter that he just showed up? They're baseball players. There's a lot of traveling. There's a lot of lateness. He's here. You traded for him. He's only going to be here for 2 months because he's a free agent at the end of the year. Get him in the lineup. Now, with that said, it's not like Cedric Mullins did much because he eventually got into this game in the ninth inning and he popped up. And then we saw him all weekend do very little offensively. But it was a feeling I had Friday. Can we get this guy in the lineup? And instead, the Mets lose. I mean, the positive was Ryan Helsley. You know, I know he gave up a couple of base hits, but we saw Helsley strike out three guys, make the big pitch when he needed to as he adjusted to his new role, which is, I mean, actually, his new role, we haven't seen yet because he came into a tie game in the ninth inning. That's essentially what he would have done in St. Louis because that's what closers do. But it allowed the Mets the weapon. The weapon of having another good reliever so they didn't have to rush and go to Edwin Diaz in the ninth inning. And if I'm going to find a positive from this weekend in which the Mets lost 2 out of 3 to a crappy team and we've only gotten through Friday so far, the positive is the new toys look good. The positive is, you know, and you don't want to overreact to just a couple of days. I would even say that to Yankee fans. I'm actually off on Monday. I'm not doing Evan and Tiki on Monday. I don't know why I took it off. I think I decided to take that day off back in December. Little did I know I'd be going to SummerSlam the night before, so it turned out to be a good decision. But what I'd be saying about the Yankees is not about the Yankees. I'd be worried if I'm a Yankee fan. That's not my point. But I wouldn't be freaking out about Bednar and Duvall. Like, your first impression doesn't mean that's what the player is going to be. So same goes with Rodgers and Helsley. They're off to good starts. Doesn't mean they're going to be amazing, but they're off to good starts. And we've seen a preview of how deep this bullpen can be. We've seen it. We even saw it on Saturday. I jumped to the one win the Mets had, and really they scored a lot of runs, and that was what was so important, starting with Pete Alonso's three-run home run. But they didn't get good starting pitching. Kodai Senga has been roughed since he came back from the injured list, which I want to get into in a couple of minutes. But they were able to go to Reed Garrett in the fifth inning. And so you saw the beauty of this Met bullpen when they are rested, which isn't always going to be the case, but when they are rested and you can go to one of your better relievers and like Reed Garrett in the fifth inning, you just have a much deeper bullpen. And the Mets were able to show that off. And then in the eighth inning, once they took the big lead, they were able to back it off and not have to use Helsley and Diaz in back-to-back days, which kept them fresh for Sunday, even though they got their ass kicked. So early on Friday and Saturday, we saw what this bullpen can be. Now, there are still weak links in this bullpen. Ryan Stanek, how are you? But this is a much deeper bullpen. So what Stearns did improving this pen at the deadline looks fantastic. What he didn't do to add to the rotation, I can't even get mad about because there was nothing to add with. And don't give me Charlie Morton. The rotation is a problem. Like, I'll acknowledge that. But the best way to address it wasn't going to be to overpay for crappy veterans. The best way to address it is to call up Brandon Sproul. The best way to address it is to call up Nolan McClain. That's the way to address it. So I don't look at this weekend and say, yeah, the bullpen looks great. But boy, David Stearns missed out on starting pitchers. Who? I don't mean to sound like an owl, but who? Now let's get to the starting pitching because David Peterson was fine on Friday. Kodai Senga was bad, and you could see it from jump. His command was off. He was still able to make the big pitches to keep things in check until he gave up the home run to Dominic Smith in the third inning, which seemed to come out of nowhere. But Senga was off. He had no command. His ghost fork was not. I think Ron Darling mentioned this on the broadcast. He's using it way too often. Like, the ghost fork works best when you're ahead of the count. And so he's thrown it a lot. It hasn't been nearly as effective. He's walking too many guys. That's what really did him in. You go to the third inning of this game. Actually, go to the second inning of this game. He gave up the leadoff double to Schmidt. And what happens? He hits Jung Ho Lee and he walks Andrew Kisner on four pitches. You can't do that. You can't walk a guy hitting 178 on four pitches when there's already two on and nobody out. That was egregious. And speaking of egregious, he strikes out the first two guys in the third inning. At this point, you're still in a good spot. You're up 3-1 because remember, Pete hit that first inning home run. And what does he do? He walks Matt Chapman on four pitches and then falls behind Dom Smith and gives up a two-run home run. So the walks, the hit batsmen, and then falling behind hitters the way he did him in. And Senga was crappy. And there's no sugarcoating that. Since he's come back from the injured list, Kodai Senga now has made four starts. Here are his four starts. And just keep in perspective, his last start back in the middle of June was 5 2/3 innings, one hit, one walk, zero runs. He was dominating, and then obviously he got hurt. So he was pitching great. He lowered his ERA to 1.47. He went on the IL with a 1.47 ERA, and at that point had only one start where he gave up three earned runs or more. One. First start back, four scoreless innings, threw 67 pitches, probably could have gone deeper in that game, would have gone deeper into that game. Put a lot of guys on base, sure, but made the big pitches when he needed to. Four scoreless innings, big clap, good job by Kodai, all good. His second start back is when he gave up four runs to the Angels in three innings and threw 73 pitches. And so his pitch count was crazy. He gave up four runs, first time all season long he'd given that up. Remember, he only had one start prior to that where he gave up three runs or more. Only one. So, okay, bad start. You know, let's not get nuts. It's okay. His next start in San Francisco was a shaky one. Five innings, four hits, three runs, but he walked five guys. That was the problem. He put a ton of guys on base. Threw a wild pitch. He was wild. And again, he had only, prior to going on the IL, had one start where he gave up three runs or more. This is now his second. So his next start is Saturday, game two of this series against the Giants, same opponent. And we saw what happened. Four innings, five hits, four runs, three walks. His command sucked. He threw a million pitches. And so Kodai Senga has now put together three consecutive worrisome starts. Where I would be on the worry meter with Kodai Senga is that it feels like he's a perfectionist. It feels like everything needs to be in order for him to be effective. And for the most part, they've been in order. His mechanics have worked. That's why his career numbers in the limited time we saw him, I don't even want to include last year, but this season were so good. And you go back to his rookie season, had a very good year. So unless you're telling me there's some kind of injury we're not aware of, I'm not fully worried, but there's no denying he's on a streak of struggling. And hopefully he can figure it out. Because his next start is not going to be the easiest one. It's going to be in Milwaukee against, you know, right now, pound for pound, the best team in the National League. A team that's not only been the best team in the league for the last 2 months, but their overall record is the best in the sport. You would think he would have gotten things going on Saturday, and he didn't. And so Kodai is in a funk right now. And considering the questions around the fourth and fifth starter on this team, it makes the funk look worse because of his struggles. Now, the good news was the Met bullpen did a really, really good job cleaning up that mess. I talked about it earlier, Reed Garrett coming into the game in the fifth inning, which they're now able to do because of their deeper bullpen. They were also able to score runs. You know, Brandon Nimmo had three hits, drove in runs in all of those situations. Pete hit the three-run home run. Francisco Lindor had three hits, including the bunt base hit that drove in a run. Two-run hit in the seventh, RBI hit in the sixth. So we saw specifically the one, two, and four hitters, three-fourths of the Flushing Four, whatever you want to call them, have a very productive day. And that was great to see because the Mets were able to put up a crooked number of runs. It was also really important when they broke the game open in the seventh because it allowed Carlos Mendoza to not have to use Helsley again, not have to use Diaz again. And so instead it was Brooks Raley and Rico Garcia. Unfortunately, that did Enrico Garcia because he got DFA'd or sent down after the game. DFA'd, actually. Because, well, that last spot in the bullpen is like a roving spot until Brazoban comes back. Or maybe Paul Blackburn comes back, we'll see, to take up that spot. And so Rico Garcia didn't get DFA'd because he gave up a two-run home run to Willy Adames with a big lead. He got DFA'd because they needed another body. And little did we know, after they lost the game on Saturday, that they were going to need that body. Austin Warren, who came in and pitched a bunch of innings to clean up the absolute dog crap performance by Frankie Montas. I'm not worried about Kodai Senga. At least I'm not worried about him yet. But this just may be Frankie Montas. There's a reason why none of us were excited when they signed him. And we talked ourselves into the fact, well, it's the pitching lab. They'll help figure it out. Well, right now, Frankie Montas has come back. He's had his little pitching lab. He's now made eight starts. And I would argue that five of the eight have been crappy. But this latest one was a disaster. You know, he comes into this game, retires the first six guys. You're feeling like, oh, okay, we may get good Frankie Montas. And then the third inning was just the thing that did him in. Leadoff hit to Jung Ho Lee. You had the stolen base and the error, which was called on Alvarez, but should have been called on Lindor when Lee stole second base, which we're not used to because the Mets have done such a good job of shutting down opponent running games that when they actually get a stolen base, and in this case, a stolen base and then an E2, it's almost stunning. because it so doesn't happen. But obviously the Devers bomb, and then it got worse in the fourth inning, and it turned into just a, what I like to call just a non-competitive start by Frankie Montas. And that can't happen. And when you look now at his last two starts, the game against San Diego where it got derailed in the fifth inning, and then this start where it got derailed in the third and fourth inning, there are a couple of thoughts I have. Number one, I don't care how much money he's making. This is nut-crunching time. The Mets are in a pennant race. I don't know if I want this guy in the rotation anymore. And the fact that his last couple of starts featured good starts to his performance could almost lead you to say he could be good out of the bullpen. This start against San Francisco, which its final line is awful because he gave up 7 runs in 4 innings. Well, yeah, the 7 runs came on the third and fourth inning. You know what I mean? So he actually got off to a good start as much as we forget it. You go to his previous start, not that he was dominating, but first 2 innings, he gave up no runs. First 4 innings, he only gave up 1 run. The start got derailed in the fifth inning. So maybe it's me talking myself into the fact that you're not DFAing this guy. If you demote him, which you could, by the way, if you're David Stearns, you could demote him. I don't give a crap how much you pay him. And the reason you could demote him is because you have two guys at AAA who are banging down the door. So when you've got multiple guys in Nolan McLean and Brandon Sproat who are doing everything you ask them to do, they are now dominating AAA. You have every right to say, sorry, this is a performance business. And you, Frankie Montas, you're not getting the job done. You're not going to be buried forever because God knows we need a sixth starter because Kodai Senga can't pitch on regular rest. And based on the way Clay Holmes and David Peterson and everyone else pitches on regular rest, nobody should pitch on regular rest. So don't worry, Frankie. You'll probably get another start. But if you're David Stearns and you're Carlos Mendoza, you have every right to demote this guy. And you can convince yourself, the way I am here on the Rico, well, he may be good for the first 2 innings out of the bullpen since he's been more effective that way. Why the hell not? So is it too early, 7 starts into his Met tenure, to demote Frankie Montas? Not really. They were pretty quick to demote Adrian Hauser last year. Spoiler alert, it took a year, but look how good Adrian Hauser is now. I don't think any of us saw that coming. But the beautiful thing, and yes, I'm going to use the word beautiful. The beautiful thing about the Met rotation issues is that they have options. You know, we're sitting here now a few days after the trade deadline, and it's easy. I'm not going to do it because I don't agree with it. It is easy to say, boy, David Stearns missed on not adding a starting pitcher. That's not true. There's no starting pitcher that was traded that they really missed on. We're going to go through a lot of these emails, thericob@gmail.com. We appreciate everyone's interaction. But I got one saying, what about Charlie Morton? Really? Charlie Morton? The 74-year-old Charlie Morton? Give me a break. I'd rather see Brandon Sproat. I'd rather see Nolan McLean. You got two studs in the minors who are knocking on the door. So anytime you want to make a change, because of Montas's performance, or maybe you are concerned about Clay Holmes, if you want to make a change, you actually have options. I'm not even including Paul Blackburn, who I guess is an option too.
Stop. Don't
Which
even
part?
Say that.
Which part?
And here's, and here, well, the part about talking about Blackburn coming
I threw
in.
That at the end. Obviously, it's.
I understand. But I mean, dude, it's bad enough that we see Frankie Montas every fifth or sixth day. Here's the problem I have is, and I get it. Charlie Morton, definitely no. The guys that were traded, no. I wouldn't have done anything to go for them. But they did not upgrade at pitcher, and we're still running out the same crap. At what point in time are they going to be like, okay, we now need to make the move to bring these young kids up because we have to see if they could perform at this level? It should have been yesterday.
It's getting soon, bro. It's going to happen because in August, coming up soon, not this week, but soon, they're going to need a sixth starter. They're not going to stick with a five-man rotation when they don't have an off day for a while. So that day is coming, and I do think the sixth starter is going to be one of the kids. But, no, they have every right now to demote Frankie Montas. They could. Clay Holmes, they could as well if they want to. I think we've seen more from Clay Holmes, so it's easier to give him more time. But the first sentence that you put out there doesn't make any sense. And that first sentence is, I didn't want to trade for any of the starters that were out there, but. Well, but what?
No.
Like, what,
no,
what are you bitching about? The Marlins clearly weren't going to trade Sandy Alcantara. They didn't trade him.
I said this. The pitchers that were traded, I wouldn't have traded for any of them. The only guy I might have done was Shane Bieber. I understand others didn't move, and that's an argument that I don't agree with. Well, just because people were rumored to be on the block and they didn't move, so you can't talk about them. Bullshit. You know, at some point in time, you got to pull a trigger and say, are we winning now this year? Are we going to go win a World Series, or are we going to go and just kind
which
of
pitcher?
Go through this malaise?
Which pitcher?
I would have gone for Alcantara.
Okay, but let's stick with him and let's use logic, right? The Marlins didn't have to trade him. And we've talked about this all season long, that they'd be dumb to trade him when, for the most part, he hasn't had a good year. I know he's been better lately, but he hasn't had a good year. It'd be dumb for the Marlins. And forget about how hot they are, because the Marlins could also sell, hey, we got a chance to make the playoffs. We don't lose anymore. We swept the Yankees. We're in it. We've been a better team than the Mets and the Phillies since the middle of June. Why are we doing this? But forget that. Forget that. Because that's kind of like probably a fairy tale, though you never know.
Right.
They did not have to trade this man. And because they didn't have to trade this man, I don't know how you or anyone else could say the Mets screwed up by not getting him. They didn't have to trade him. They could have been sitting there, and they probably were, saying, you want Sandy Alcantara? Okay, we want Jonah Tong and Nolan McClain. And I don't know many Met fans that would have accepted that kind of offer. So how could we be mad about Sandy Alcantara when they didn't have to trade him? They didn't trade him. And yeah, I guess the Mets could have blown them away, but no one would have been comfortable with the blown away offer.
At this point in time, I know that Sandy Alcantara, no matter how bad he's been, and then the fact that you have control over him for a few years, it's in a better situation than let's cross our fingers that McClain and Tong can't actually pitch in the majors. You don't know.
And if you would have traded both of them? Is that what you're saying?
I got to be honest with you. Zach Gallen, Alcantara, there's a couple guys that I still would have made a move for. And if you needed to trade both, I probably would have.
That's where there's a divide. That's where I just say you're nuts.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
And look, maybe 3 years from now, you could cut this clip and say, you were wrong, Evan. Look at these schmucks. They're not any good. And that may be the case. I totally understand the risk of that. But at least for me, I can't get crazy about not trading for starting pitchers that weren't traded and would have probably cost an arm and a leg. So it's not ideal, just like it isn't ideal for any other team that needed to add starting pitching. But at least the Mets have the ability. And you want to say cross your fingers, fine. But at least they have the ability to take two top 100 prospects who are banging on the door at AAA and say, enter the rotation. You can make a big impact on this team.
Well, then put them the freak in, dude.
I agree.
Because I'm tired of this mess. You can't keep on running out Frankie Montas and be like, oh, you know, he just has to work on a couple things.
I agree. Yeah,
go work on the minors. And I'm sorry, Clay Holmes is in the same boat. You could sit there and try to say, hey, listen, he's a five-inning pitcher. He's a fifth starter. Guess what? Is that fifth starter going to be pitching every fifth day for us? And is he going to be keeping us in games? Because I don't think he is. I really don't.
The difference between Clay Holmes and Frankie Montas is Clay Holmes has given you more reason to believe than Frankie Montas has. Now, in Frankie's case, it's a smaller sample size. But, I mean, you look, Clay Holmes' last start was a disaster. There's no sugarcoating it. The only thing you could say is it was regular rest. And we've seen a trend from a few of these starting pitchers that they don't pitch well on regular rest. But the start before that was five innings, one run, which is a good start. I know it's not deep, but if you're going to get – look, this is all like a chain reaction. Five innings, one run is wonderful. And it'd be more acceptable that it's only five innings if Kodai Senga was going more than four. And so when you've got Senga struggling too, it makes the five-inning performance worse. But Clay Holmes has given me less of a reason to demote him than Frankie Montas has. So if I have to make a decision, and we could make one right now going into this week against Cleveland and then Milwaukee, I would go to Frankie Montas and say you're going to the bullpen. And good news, Frankie, you're not buried forever because, like I said, there's going to be a sixth starter needed. So you'll make another start, but you're going to the bullpen, and I'm calling up McClain or Sprout. And you can take your pick because both of these guys have done a really good job over their last six, seven starts. And we go from there. And that's the thing that can really change this rotation, along with Senga pitching better. I mean, sometimes it's boring to say it, but sometimes you need guys to just play better. And Kodai Senga is certainly one of them.
My one question, though, if you put Montas to the bullpen, who are you going to DFA or send down? Because Rico Garcia is not here anymore.
Austin Warren.
Oh, God.
Austin Warren took Rico Garcia's spot, and God bless Austin Warren, because after Frankie Montas dropped the giant turd all over the field against the San Francisco Giants, Warren sort of kept him in the game. That was, of course, until Ryan Stanek came in and lit the whole game on fire to the point where we had to see Luis Torrens pitch, which is... But let's also not bury the fact, because yes, Frankie Montas sucked. And I'm glad that that was the first thing we said about Sunday's game. But the offense, again, just does nothing. And Carson Wisenhunt, the kid who made the start, is a good prospect. And who knows, years from now, we'll be talking about, that young ace Carson Wisenhunt, his second major league start, he put the Mets in knots. But other than Lindor's home run in the bottom of the first inning, I mean, it was the same crap from this offense. You know, they give you so much to like on Saturday by dropping the 12th spot, and now you're facing a young starting pitcher. You jump on them quick with the Lindor home run, and they couldn't build off of it. I thought what was really discouraging was when Francisco Alvarez drew a one-out walk in the third inning. At this point, they're down 4-1. It was right after Montas gave up the home run to Devers. It's still a game, though. It's 4-1. You're facing a young pitcher. You get a one-out walk from Alvarez. You got the top of the order coming up. I thought great response situation. Great chance for this offense, which has been so spotty all year. But, hey, they're coming off a 12-runner on Saturday to respond. And Nimmo popped up and Lindor struck out. And then it continued all day, where the offense did nothing, just nothing. They had some opportunities to score. Pete bounced into that double play against Jose Puto, of all people. And it was a combination of, yes, the starting pitching is spotty. We just had a discussion about it. But this offense has been spotty all year long. And I do point to Juan Soto. I do point to Juan. And as we get set to give our net negative, and our Rico, I'm the man now, star of the series, I'll tell you right now, Juan Soto's the net negative. And here's why Juan Soto is the net negative. Go back to game one. Go back to the beginning of this thing. Think about his game, and I'll tell you all about his game. A game in which he went, let's see, how did he do in game one? Let me pull up my scorecard. Take a look at Juan's performance. Juan was 1-for-4. Grounded out in the first inning. Got hit in the fourth inning, struck out in the sixth inning, gets a big hit in the eighth inning. So, yeah, so far in this game, he's 1-for-4, hadn't come up with guys on base. And then he comes up in this huge spot in the 10th inning, 2 on, 1 out, down by a run, and he pops up. I bring that up because we know Juan has had his struggles with runners in scoring position. On Friday, he was 1-for-2. You go to Saturday's game, a game they did win. But Juan Soto came up with 2 on and nobody out in the bottom of the first inning. And you guys remember what he did before Pete hit the home run? He struck out. That's called 1-for-3 with runners in scoring position. Then in the fourth inning, after Lindor laid down that bunt to drive in a run, Juan came up with a chance to really break the game open. Runners in scoring position, 2 on. And he bounced into a 4-6-3 double play. 1-for-4 with runners in scoring position. Then he came up in the sixth with guys on base, and he had a foul pop-up. 1-for-5 with runners in scoring position. Then he came up in the seventh inning with guys on base, and he grounded out to first base. 1-for-6 with runners in scoring position. And then you go to the finale of this series, in which he just goes a very weak 1-for-4, and you combine it all together, he He was 3 for 13. He was 1 for 6 with runners in scoring position. And when he had a chance to make an impact, a big impact, he didn't do anything. So am I being a guy right now being unfair to Juan Soto? I'm sure some may think that. They'll point to his overall numbers and say, stop bitching and whining. But I don't think that's the case. He was 3 for 13. He was quiet like a church mouse. And in game one, when he had a chance to make an impact, he popped up. So I'll fight with you, Pete, if you want it to be Frankie Montas. I'll fight with you if you want it to be, you know, Ryan Stanek because he blows. But I'd tell you right now, the net negative of this series was Juan Soto. Am I wrong?
I mean, you don't want to pick Stanek?
It's easy. We could. I mean, look, I would say this. Game three was already over when he came in.
Right.
He did give up a run in the seventh inning of game one that turned a 2-0 game into a 3-0 game that the Mets would erase. So, yeah, Ryan Stanek sucked in this series. There's no defending it. But in terms of the overall negative impact, I'd say Soto hasn't beat. Tell me why.
Now, I know. I'm not going to try to fight you on this because I had my own gripes with Soto on Friday, too. He had a big opportunity. His big hit up the middle bounced off of Joey Lucchese's foot. The big RBI, that would have been a double play.
I know. He still got it, but yeah, I get it.
He still got it. I can't count that. I can't even count. I mean, you can. You have to statistically count it. But yeah, he did not have a good series. And he keeps on failing with runners in scoring position in big spots. I don't know what is wrong with him, if there's too much pressure he's feeling. But it's getting to a point where this season, it's the team goes with Francisco Lindor. If Lindor goes, the team goes. But Juan Soto is one of those like Alex Rodriguez type of players. Like he loves to pad his stats when it's not necessary. Like he needs to get a hit in a big spot.
He has gotten very few of them. It doesn't mean he hasn't gotten any of them. You know, we could sit here and trust me, we probably will on a future Rico Bronya and go through every clutch situation he's been in or every home run he's hit. And yes, some of them have been clutch, but man, it feels like he's come up in that this could be Juan Soto's moment a lot of times. And it feels like he hasn't come through one time.
No, but you know what he does do this year, which is amazing. He's got 16 stolen bases. Let's go. Amazing.
That's amazing. Great. I know you're being sarcastic. I'm not. I think that's great that he's added that to his game. But he just hasn't had enough of an impact. It's just the bottom line. It shows you that stats are stats and numbers are numbers. And his overall numbers are not bad by any stretch. But when you watch a guy every day, you have a different perspective on it. We said this a lot about Pete last year. And I love Pete Alonso, but he had a non-impactful kind of season. So the other option would have been Frankie Montas because of how bad he was. I guess you could argue Senga, though the Mets came back and won the game in which he was mediocre. I think it was either Stanek, Montas, or Soto. To me, it's Juan Soto. As far as the Rico, I'm the man now star of the series, I think it's probably Francisco Lindor. I think this was a good bounce back spot by Lindor. He gets a hit in game one. That was a part of the rally that tied the game. So he was certainly in the middle of that eighth inning rally. He got hit in the 10th inning, so you can't blame him for guys not coming through in the 10th. And then he was a big part of what happened on Saturday when they scored as many runs as they did. He had that great 10-pitch at-bat, second at-bat of the game. Remember, Nimmo got hit to start the game, and then Lindor had this great 10-pitch at-bat, drew a walk, two batters later, Pete 3-run home run. And even though the Mets would blow that lead and go down 4-3, they obviously came back. And part of how they came back was Francisco Lindor laying down the bunt RBI hit, had an RBI hit in the sixth, drove in two more runs in the seventh to break the game open. So I thought Lindor overall had a good series. He even hit a home run in the stinker of game three that gave him the early lead. So overall, he was 5 for 11 with a home run and 5 RBIs. I don't think there's really anybody else. I mean, Brandon Nimmo had a decent series. Pete obviously broke out of it a little bit. But I think overall, Francisco Lindor deserves it. It's a bittersweet win because the Mets lost 2 out of 3. But I do think he's the I'm the man now star of the series, which for him would be the first time Lindor has won that award. You ready for this? since sweeping the Rockies in Colorado. It's been a long time. He had won it four times, but it had been a long time since Lindor won an I'm the Man Now star of the series, which shows you how long this slump has been going on.
Well, Lindor, again, and he add two more walks to it. His on-base percentage this series was over 500, which was really nice, too. I mean, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for a guy who early in the order gets on base, and that's what he was doing, and he's driving the runs. I still think that Francisco Lindor, the biggest problem right now between Lindor and Alonso, I'll throw Soto in the mix there, too. They're all super streaky at the moment. It is not good. It's the entire team.
Yeah.
You talk about Brett Beatty. Brett Beatty goes hot for like a couple days and we get excited, and then he's off for like 2 weeks. Lindor goes off for a week, on for a week, off for a week. Alonso, same thing. It's these stretches are going too long, and it's too many of them at the same time.
Well, I think that last part is the real problem. You know, if Lindor is red hot and Pete is struggling, and the bottom of the order has certainly woken up, even though it's different guys doing it. We saw Beatty contribute for a while. Now he's cooled off. Mauricio contribute for a little bit. Vientos. If you can at least have two of the big four guys red hot and two of them struggling, you may be able to overcome it. But you had Lindor and Alonso going through a massive slump all at the same time. So we'll make it official. Francisco Lindor, for a team-leading fifth time, is the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series, tying Pete Alonso, who's also done it five times. And Juan Soto is the net negative for the fifth time. But much like Lindor, Soto hadn't won a net negative since the White Sox series. So both guys hadn't picked up that award in a long time. You know you can knock one out of the park and raise that apple, even when the Mets lose sometimes, with Takara Chuhai. It's a sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field in Fuji Apple, White Peach, and Lemon. Let's hear from you. We'll preview the Cleveland series. We'll look ahead. I'll make an even stronger case for why one of the young kids needs to come up to enter this rotation, but I want to spend some time talking to the people. We appreciate your emails, therico@gmail.com. I'll start from most recent and work my way backwards. Kenneth Torres sent this email 1 minute ago. So Kenneth is probably thinking, boy, that's some instant reaction. But like I said, I'm going from newest to oldest. Kenneth writes, punked. Are the Mets punking us? That's an interesting one. Punking us. Like they're punking us, or they're a pumpkin that we thought was, what was the thing in Cinderella where it turned into a beautiful stagecoach
and then it turned into a pumpkin? Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen that movie in a while. Are the Mets pumpkin us? Are they going to stay above water until the season is over and just make it into the playoffs? Then the light switch comes on and they'll start scoring runs, hitting with runners in scoring position. I'm not feeling confident about this team right now. Ken Torres. Yeah, it's tough to be confident. Their offense all season long has been crappy. I don't think it's about turning the switch on. I think it's about playing their best baseball at the right time of the year. And it felt, which is so crazy, a week and a half ago was their best baseball. They win the last game against Cincy. They sweep the Angels. They sweep the Giants. They'd won seven in a row. And their response to that is to go lose 5 out of 6. And V writes, I know it's hard to blame coaches since they're not the ones swinging the bat, but listening to the entire team talk about staying the course and sticking to the game plan only for either the whole team to hit or look lifeless. At what point is the hitting coach's game plan the problem? On a side note, did anyone get the feeling in the ninth that this could be a repeat of the eighth inning against the Braves in 2000 when they scored 10 runs with two outs, only to watch Mendoza basically say, hey, let's go home and send Tyrone Taylor to pinch hit and send everybody home? No, I'll start off with the first part. I never thought the eighth inning was going to turn into that infamous inning against Atlanta when they scored all those runs. Never once did I feel that way. So I don't know what made you feel that way, but that is never how I felt. And I'm trying to think, Tyrone Taylor didn't hit in that inning. So I wonder if you're thinking about a different inning where Taylor came up and basically killed the team. Because Tyrone Taylor pinch hit for Brandon Nimmo. Did he pinch in the eighth inning? Actually, let me take a look. Sunday's game was a weird one because I was scoring it. I was watching it. Then I had to leave to go to SummerSlam. So it was one of those rare games. I actually had to stop scoring and then I go back and then rewatch it, which is not something I like to do, but yeah, I guess I have to do that. I'm trying to see when Tyrone Taylor pinch hit in this game, but no, I never felt that we were going to have. Oh, he pinch hit for Brandon Nimmo in the bottom of the ninth inning. You didn't think they were rallying in the ninth inning. They were down 12-2. That's when you thought the Mets were rallying? Come on, you're nuts. David writes, Evan, I understand the Mets offense is good on paper. I don't think anyone could disagree with that. That said, the Mets offense truly isn't good. As of Saturday on the season, the Mets are 23rd in baseball in hits per game and 17th in runs per game. In almost 60% of their games this season, the Mets have scored four runs or less. Four freaking runs or less. So that means they're forcing their pitchers to give up three runs or less in 60% of their games to give them a chance to win. The Mets and the Astros are the only first-place teams. Mets are not in first place anymore, but you know what I'm getting at. They are not in the top 10 in runs per game. The Mets, Astros, and Padres are the only playoff position teams not in the top 10 in runs per game. The team was built to score runs all season. They haven't been doing it. This isn't a month or two long slump. It's all season. I don't see them turning this around. There is zero flicker of hope that makes one think this offense will spark. The plan experiment for 2025 looks to be failing, and 2025 is quickly spiraling. Dave in Texas. Dave, I can't argue the offensive numbers. Can't do it. Can't argue that the production through 112 games says this is a below average offense, because that's what they've been. The flicker of hope I'll give you, because you said I don't see any hope on how this changes. One thing, and I've been picking on Juan Soto throughout this podcast, I don't think Juan Soto is a 180 hitter with runners in scoring position. Me being angry at what he did in this series, me calling him out for that, doesn't mean I don't think he can ever turn it around. So one flicker of hope I would give you, Dave, is what if Juan Soto actually starts to hit with guys on base? What if? That's a flicker of hope. That's a flicker of hope. Matt writes, does anyone think Frankie Montas is a good pitcher? Does anyone think it's a good idea to have him and Clay Holmes in your rotation? Have the Mets really not developed one or two good starting pitchers from their farm system? Is that really the case that no one is ever ready and ever going to be ready? Who is the last starting pitcher the Mets have developed? David Peterson? Matt. Yeah. I mean, they haven't developed pitching in a while. I don't think there's any question about that. The hope is that they're about to. And Brandon Sproat and Nolan McClain haven't failed. They just haven't been given the opportunity yet at the major league level. Brandon Sproat, in his last five starts at AAA, and this is why I say he's banging on the door. Let me give you the numbers to Brandon Sproat's last five starts. And then maybe, to answer Matt's question, the next starting pitcher they'll develop will actually be Brandon Sproat. His last five starts, four of them, he has not allowed a run in. 28 innings, two runs, 30 strikeouts, eight walks. ERA under one. As the kids like to say, he is shoving. I don't care about what they haven't developed in recent years. All I care about is what can they do today and what can they do tomorrow. And Brandon Sproat is earning his opportunity here. Nolan McClain is earning his opportunity here. And when you have underwhelming performances from Frankie Montas specifically and sure Clay Holmes, there is every reason for the Mets to say, you know what? You've earned it. You haven't earned it. Let's go. Hewitt writes, and here's the subject. We need to keep Montas. All right, well, let's read the email. Evan and Pete, I've been listening to the pod since the end of last season, and I'm a first-time emailer. Okay. Disclaimer, this is a fairly long email, but hopefully you'll find it well thought out. You guys ready for a really long email? Why the hell not? It's a freaking podcast. If you're bored by it, hit the 30-second button. You could start skipping. But I don't think you should do that because I think Hewitt's going to give us a well-thought-out email. So let's read it. I would say I've been disappointed in Montas, But I, like many of you Met fans, was skeptical of the signing in the first place. That being said, I don't think he's the type of guy you can just cut, both for financial and lack of suitable replacements. Say we bring up the young guys. You have to assume it will not likely not work out. Otherwise, they would have been up here already. Blake Tidwell is an example this year of what can happen when you call a pitcher up too early for a spot start. Inevitably, we'll be stuck with a bunch of Hagenman-Waddell combined bullpen games, both of whom fill their roles adequately for who they are, but it is not much of an upgrade over Montas. I know we rotate a lot of relievers, but it's just not possible in the same way for starters. Notice how hard it is to actually acquire starting pitching. Montas getting the contract is a good example. Similarly, we need to give up prospects, not very good ones, but still, to get Paul Blackburn, who is functionally equivalent to Montas, and note how we still kept Blackburn on the team. I believe Stearns would have added another starter at the deadline if the right opportunity came along, but those were available would have had a Blackburn-Montas level of inconsistency or would have costed a King's ransom no sensible person would pay. The only other option to add external reinforcements is to sign some washed-up free agent who hasn't played in months and ask him to start in the middle of a pennant race, a la Julio Teheran last year, for those who remember. So what is the solution? By the way, before I read his solution, the one thing I disagree about is saying that if they believed in Sproat or McClain, they would have called him up earlier. I think they do believe in him, but they wanted them to succeed at a high level of AAA. I don't think they believed much in Blake Tidwell, which is why they were quick to include him in a trade for a relief pitcher who's a free agent at the end of the year. I don't think it's because he failed in his brief time up here. They're not viewing him as highly as they view the others. So I disagree with that part that, I mean, will it likely fail? I don't know. They're young pitchers. I'm not expecting the moon from them, but I also don't think I would say they'd likely fail. But either way, here are his solutions. One, we either have to ride it out with Montas as a starter. Two, we send him to the bullpen, which can actually work. Remember Adrian Hauser at an 8.55 ERA in 33 innings as a starter and a 3.28 ERA in 35 innings as a reliever. Number three, we hope he agrees to a mental health reset IL trip, which is basically a demotion, except we can keep Montas in the system and he'll just trade places with Blackburn. What are your thoughts? I trust Stearns will make the right decision either way, but I just don't see a scenario where Montas is still on the team, or at least until the end of the season, or a scenario where Montas is not on the team. Yeah, I'm not saying they should DFA. I think that would actually be rash, believe it or not, considering the contract you gave him, the money you paid him. You're not DFAing him after seven starts. I would demote him to the bullpen right now. I would call up one of the young arms. In fact, if my days are correct, both Sproat and McClain haven't pitched in 4 or 5 days, so they'd be ready to go pretty soon. Let me look up Nolan McClain first just to prove my point on this, because I would kind of manipulate the next couple of days, because what I don't want to see is guys on regular rest when they don't have to. So Nolan McClain's last start was July 30th. So 31st, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, he's good to go if the Mets want to use him and add him to the rotation, because this series against Cleveland features Sean Manaea, no problem. Clay Holmes, no problem. But the Wednesday game is David Peterson on regular rest, and David Peterson on regular rest has been a disaster. So what I would do is not start David Peterson Wednesday against Cleveland. Wednesday start, a nice afternoon game against the Cleveland Guardians, would be either Nolan McClain or Brandon Sproat, and it works days-wise. By the way, perspective on Nolan McClain. His last handful of starts, July 30th, 6 innings, 2 runs. Start before that, 7 1/3 innings, 2 runs. His start before that was a dud, 3 2/3 innings, 5 runs. His start before that, 6 scoreless innings. So 3 of his last 4, if you really want to extend it, basically all of his starts outside of that dud he had against Norfolk have been really good. And days-wise, it would work for him to be slotted in this week. As far as Brandon Sproat's concerned, I gave you his stats recently or about 5 minutes ago on how effective he's been. His last start was July 31st. So same thing. His day is coming up early this week. But here are his last few starts. Five scoreless, five innings, two runs, five innings, one run, seven scoreless, five scoreless, six scoreless. So both of these guys have been effective, and they are in line to pitch this week. So I'll continue with my plan. I would start Manaea Monday against Cleveland, which he's going to. Clay Holmes Tuesday against Cleveland, which he's going to. And I'd bump David Peterson off Wednesday's start. I would start, let's say, Brandon Sproat. They have an off day Thursday. That would line up David Peterson, Kodai Senga, and Sean Manaea for the weekend against the Brewers. And why not? Those are your three best starters against the team that, yeah, you're kind of chasing. If the Mets win this division, which they're a half game out on, the Brewers are a team you'd love to track down. And if you could win two out of three, you get the tiebreaker against them. If you lose two out of three, it'll go to the next tiebreaker, which is your record inside the division. Then they have another off day. So I can essentially skip Frankie Montas, move him to the bullpen, call up one of these kids, and avoid David Peterson having to pitch on regular rest. What's the problem? I mean, so far, I see beauty. Then they play six games against Atlanta and Seattle, and then they have another off day. So you could technically move Montas to the bullpen. He could pitch there for about a week and a half to 2 weeks, and then eventually he'll come back in that long stretch of games they have where they go Washington, Atlanta, Philly, Miami, Detroit without an off day until the Thursday after Labor Day. So that's my answer to the question. I absolutely would call up one of these kids, specifically Brandon Sproat. I would skip Frankie Montas, and he'd be pitching out of the bullpen. Robert Cabala says the same thing. Do you believe the Mets would do the right thing and put Montas in the bullpen? The guy gets lit up like a Christmas tree every 5 days. I can see him as a 2-3 inning opener or bullpen arm with some success. Anything more leads to almost guaranteed disastrous outing. He was lit up in the minors and continues with the Mets. Dan writes, this offense loves to pretend they're good for 5 minutes and then immediately go back to who they are. Unbelievably inconsistent. You can't rely on anybody, and they all seem to do the same exact thing the exact same time. It's either all or nothing, and this year it's been way more of nothing than actually being on. It's just a bad offense, and it's time to admit it. They've had 112 games to figure it out. And even when they have their one good day and make everyone think they finally have it, they come back the next day and turn into this pathetic limp noodle that they are. At least we got Cedric Mullins and all those relievers, though. Jury's obviously out on Cedric Mullins if he can help with this situation. I don't like to poo-poo the bullpen. I mean, let's be honest. The bullpen looks incredibly deep. You know, Ryan Stanek sucks for a couple of days. And the truth is, if you have a rested bullpen, you never have to pitch Ryan Stanek in a high leverage spot. And think about when they used him. They used him down 2-0, so down in a game, and they used him when they were getting blown out in Sunday's game. So I like what I've seen in the early going from this bullpen, not just the two innings that Tyler Rogers and Ryan Helsley have thrown, but just how it affects everybody else. But they got a hit. That's the most important thing. I'd even put it ahead of the starting pitching they got to hit, because you can survive the four-inning performances like we saw from Senga on Saturday if you score enough runs. But it's tough to argue with Dan's point that the reality has now shown us that this is a below-average offense, because they've been that now for 112 games.
I also have another concern with this team too, because you go through this, you just went through a bunch of the schedule, and there's a lot of teams that are still fighting for playoffs. And there's one team in particular who just have had a sweep of the Yankees, who in their last, I would say, what is it, since like June, like 20-something, they're
the best team in the National League, them and the Brewers, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The Miami Marlins are on fire. And guess what? We end versus Miami in August, and we end the season versus Miami.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is a major concern. Seven more games against that team, along with Philadelphia, Detroit, I'm not even worried about. It's just, it's one of those things where this team has to take advantage when they play a bad team, like they did this weekend. The Giants, The Giants gave away their top leverage closers, right? Camille Duvall and Tyler Rogers, two of their best closers. They got rid of them, and they still lost two of three games. They're playing the Braves coming up soon. Like, you have to just the Guardians sold. You got to punk these teams, and you got to win.
Yeah, I'll tell you another team to worry about is Cincinnati, because the Reds were actually aggressive at the trade deadline. They are the last team out, if you will, and the Mets still have three more games with them. Plus, they may not have the tiebreaker because they did lose two out of three to them against Cincinnati a week and a half ago. Yeah, making the playoffs is the priority right now, and they are five games up on a playoff spot, which feels comfortable. And on Miami, they're seven games up, which, again, feels comfortable. But there is no denying that the Marlins for the last 2 months have been a better team than the Mets. I mean, it's just that's what the numbers show you. Doesn't mean that'll continue, but, yeah, the Marlins deserve their credit for the way they played.
7-17, that's all I have to say. So 7-60 or 50 or whatever, it's nothing. By the way, Zach Littell, who got traded from the Rays to the Reds, he was somebody, and I don't remember what he got traded for, but he's somebody up until his last start or two, he was like on this roll of quality starts. Like, that was actually somebody that should have been on Stern's radar.
Yeah, that was a good little deal by Cincinnati. That's the thing about the Reds. Like, most of these National League teams got better who are currently playoff teams. The only non-playoff team that was active in improving their roster was the Cincinnati Reds. No doubt about it. But you're right about beating the teams you're supposed to beat. That's what they did in the course of that seven-game winning streak. I mean, think about it. They won the last game against Cincinnati to salvage the series, and then their six wins came against Anaheim and San Francisco, which certainly contributed to the Giants selling. So you got to beat the teams that you're better than. Unfortunately, Cleveland is a decent team, despite the issues they're going through. Milwaukee is a really good team who they have coming up next weekend. Atlanta sucks, but they own the Mets, and then Seattle. So it is a little bit of a rougher stretch, and they got to find a way to just be more consistent, which has not been the case. I mean, to have a seven-game winning streak turn right into losing five out of six, it's basically like you've thrown it all back. So here's what they got coming up. I mentioned it's Manaea, Holmes, and Peterson. I suggested that Peterson not make that start, and that's a perfect moment to call up one of the young arms, push David back, give him a few extra days of rest, and give one of these kids a more comfortable landing spot at home, Cleveland. It's a lot better than throwing them in Milwaukee against the Brewer team that's played so well. But it's scheduled to be Manaea, Ciccone, Holmes, Logan Allen, a lefty, David Peterson against Gavin Williams on Wednesday afternoon, and then three games against Milwaukee. But this was disappointing. Now, the San Diego one sucked. Padres are good. Losing two out of three at home to the San Francisco Giants, in which the starters were Kang and Wisenhunt on Saturday and Sunday, it is concerning. But I have good news. I didn't go to any of the games this weekend. I had prior engagements, specifically hanging out with the family Friday, Saturday, and then going to SummerSlam on Sunday. But I miss going to Citi Field. So I plan on attending all three games against Cleveland, assuming my wife lets me. Definitely Monday and definitely Wednesday. So maybe I spark them. I do have a good win-loss record, so maybe that gets them going. Now, the other thing about going to these games is it means maybe we'll mix in some drive-home Rico. So we always tell you to download the podcast because you never know. You never know when you're going to get a drive-home Rico, Bronya, or you could check it out on YouTube Live. So figure right after a Met game, maybe you'll get a live reaction, episode 525. This has been episode 524. We do appreciate you listening, subscribing, downloading. Now that the pod is basically over, I'll give you a few minutes on SummerSlam, an event I took my kids to. Can I tell you about something weird that happened? And I am not complaining because I was very lucky to be sitting close to ringside. And that was really cool. And I appreciate the WWE. But when you sit ringside, what you may not know is you get to keep the chairs. Very, very cool little feature that the chairs are designed. They've got the SummerSlam logo. And I've done this before. I actually did it at an AEW event a few years ago. And a couple of times in WWE history, I've done it. So I know the way the routine is, which is the show ends, security comes over, they check your ticket, they snap the chair because they're usually connected, and you take the chair home. Hoff had the opportunity to do that Saturday. You successfully got your chairs, went home, had a good time?
I had two chairs. I'm very happy about it. It's amazing.
I'm going to preface this by saying I am not bitching. Okay. I want to let you know what happened. So I had four tickets. I took both of my sons and my dad. So three generations of Roberts were at SummerSlam. So we're going to get four chairs. Now, do we need four chairs? Not necessarily, but we have four tickets. So we're going to get four chairs. So the event ends. Crazy event. I can't believe they brought Brock Lesnar back. I mean, the guy's named all over the Jhené Grant lawsuit. And there's some pretty bad accusations against him. Again, we don't know if it's true, but his name is in it. And they brought this guy back. And I don't think we even need to see Brock Lesnar. Like, Brock's, we've seen him do it all. So it's one of those things where if you're the WWE, you can play it conservatively and say, hey, let's not deal with the guy named in this lawsuit because what do we really gain from it? So I was stunned they brought him back. I almost kind of laughed and said, boy, I'll tell you guys are something else. So do I love the return? Not really. And it isn't even like I give you the moral stuff, but I'll also say, like, I'm not interested in Brock Lesnar. Now, it got a big pop, and my son, who my oldest son doesn't know much about this lawsuit. I haven't told him. Maybe I should. I was like, whoa. Like, he was excited about Brock coming back. But I don't need to see Brock Lesnar, John Cena for the 500th time. I thought Cena, Cody Rhodes, though, was an amazing, incredibly booked match. So kudos, changing of the guard, the handshake at the end, the hug at the end, all great. Anyhow, back to the chairs. So we're waiting for them to cut the chairs. And this guy comes over, seems like a real nice guy. And he's like, I'll help you out. And he rips one of the chairs off. And I'm like, oh, thank you, man. I really appreciate it. Then I'm like, I got this. And he's like, no, I got this for you. Rips off the other chair. As that's happening, security comes over to do the snippet. The guy left with one of our chairs. He literally ripped it off. I look at my dad. I said, did that guy just take the chair? And he's like, yeah. And I said, what a douche. I'm not crying. We've got three of them. We don't need four of them. But I would have rather have given it to somebody like Tommy Lugauer or a kid who listens to the Rico. I don't need douchey McDouche ripping it off and taking it away. And what makes it worse is he sees I'm with two kids. Like, what kind of human does that? So, not pitching, more just telling the story of some guy who I thought was being helpful, but really just wanted a chair for his own.
I noticed the chaos. This is the second time now that I've gone to a WWE event and I've gotten a chair. And I do realize that, and Sal and I and Mitch and my son were very careful about how I just told everyone, first of all, I'm bigger than most people there that aren't wrestling. So, like, it to me, like, people aren't going to come and mess with my chairs. But they worked. I saw them, like, ripping off other people's. And I'm like, nah, I got it, dude. Don't worry about it. And then they'd step away. Because of that, I know how shady they are. And now you're supposed to get a check on your hand. Yeah. You're supposed to get a lot of different stuff. They're supposed to check the ticket. It doesn't make a difference. People always find a way to take that stuff. And I was not going to have it.
Yeah. Knowing that, what I should have done when that guy came over said, we're good. I don't think he would have fought me about it. I think he just would have moved on. But instead, I was like, oh, thanks, man. Like, hey, I appreciate that. Meanwhile, he swiped one of our chairs.
Dude, and he probably stole it for $200.
I know.
You know how much I was getting offered as I was walking out? People were offering me their first kid. It's crazy.
You didn't sell them, right?
No, I got them upstairs. I told my wife, asked me, she said, I don't even want to spoil it because there might be people might be listening, but somebody that we know is a big fan. So we are going to gift him a chair.
That's right. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, I don't need four chairs, so I'm not crying that I don't have them. It was more, that's a great gift. That's a great, someone will appreciate it. The only thing that matters, and you know this, I think most people listening know this, who have multiple kids, each kid needs one of what we got. Like, if we only had one chair, it would have been World War VII. But instead, we do have three, so it was fine, and it's wonderful. It was more like, I can't believe someone would do that.
Oh, I can. That's the thing. People were hunting us down. I was online for the bathroom when people were like, yo, how much for that chair? I was like, I gotta go take a piss. And then like, I'll be right back. And they were waiting as I came out. Like, I thought it was gonna be like a decoy. No, yeah. they were hungry for those chairs.
Bro. They were hungry for those chairs. But it was fun going to SummerSlam. I was saying this to my dad, like, when was the last time me and him went to a WWE, now they call it PLE, but a pay-per-view. And we figured out the last time me and my dad, and obviously my kids were now involved, went to a PLE was the Royal Rumble in 2004, which was in Philadelphia. I was living in Maryland. He was in New York. And we met. We met in Philadelphia, and we went to the Royal Rumble. I am not allowed to say who won that Royal Rumble because that guy doesn't exist. So we'll leave it at that, bro. I ain't going to say anything else, but the guy, you know, is kind of a murderer. So so that was the last time. But it was kind of cool seeing MetLife Stadium and being at a SummerSlam. So fun experience for those that care. But we got a lot of Ricos coming up. I'm going to Citi Field for these games, so we'll do some drive homes. We'll obviously do our series recap at some point Wednesday evening after the series ends against the Guardians. And hopefully the Mets can turn this thing around because losing 5 out of 6 to the Padres and the Giants, not fun. Any thoughts? Of course, interact with us, thericob@gmail.com. Thericob@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Hold on. I have to stop because it's almost like Brock Lesnar. I have to interrupt. Jared from Boston, I just want to give a shout out because at the WWE event, I've never been more recognized in my entire life. I got to be honest with you. Everywhere I walked, they were talking about the Rico Bronya podcast. I got stopped every which place in the world. People behind me like, dude, I didn't want to interrupt you during this whole event, but I listened to you every Rico. So, but Jared up in Boston, big Rico fan, been living in Boston for 3 years, but is an avid listener. So thank you, Jared.
I got to meet Jared. He was a very nice guy, and he said something that made me feel so bad. I didn't even want to say anything back. He said, hey, I got a long drive home tonight. Can't wait to listen to the Rico. And I was thinking to myself, this poor bastard, I ain't getting this Rico Bruna done for a few hours. You're not listening to this on the drive home. He may be listening to this on his drive to work on Monday morning, but I do appreciate that. And one last thing for you, and you got to be honest, okay? Because I am curious. You were recognized more for the Rico than producing the midday program?
Oh, dude, 100. And I love Sal, and I was next to Sal the whole time, and everyone kept on coming up to me. They're like, dude, I love the podcast. I love the podcast. I'm like, or would say, I love the show. And I'm like, well, have you met Sal? Oh, yeah. That's fine. I wanted to talk to you. People were taking pictures with me. I'm like, I didn't get it. I'm like, I guess the Rico's really taken. That's my crowd. Rico Bronya audience is WWE fan. All right. Sounds good. Let's go.
Yes. No, we got a lot of wrestling fans out there. Hopefully for those that went to MetLife, you had a damn good time. And you didn't get, you know, anything robbed from you, like a chair or something worse for that matter. Anyhow, thank you very much for listening, subscribing, hanging out on another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.